Welcome to Season 7 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $95 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is the CEO of a leading international educational organization. She graduated from the University of North Carolina with a bachelor's and master's degree in biostatistics before starting her career in the private sector in the pharma space. She continued her education at Berkeley, getting further degrees in South Asian studies. Side note, your host is feeling a little undereducated right about now. Before finding her true calling when she started working at the nonprofit Room to Read, an organization that believes world change starts with educated children. Room to Read is a remarkable group which literally transforms the lives of millions of children through education, working to create a world free from illiteracy and gender inequality. HPS CEO Scott Kapnick is on the board of Room to Read, and as individuals and an organization, we are proud to support their incredible efforts. So without any further ado, I am honored to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Geetha Murali, CEO of Room to Read. Geetha, welcome to the pod.
Thanks so much, Colbert. Great to be here.
Geetha, let's go all the way back. Where did you grow up? Where are you from originally?
Well, I was born in New York and spent a few years of my childhood there before going back to India and finishing some middle school years there and then coming back to the United States, and have been up and down the East Coast through my high school and university education before coming out to California, where I've been for the last two decades.
So let's go then through your education. So you started at University of North Carolina. Why was that the right choice for you undergrad? And before you answer, as listeners know, I'm from the old North State. So because UNC is awesome is an acceptable answer. I want to be clear.
Well, UNC is awesome. So you've got that right. But somewhat convoluted story as to how I ended up there. I am the only child of first generation immigrants from India. And so my mom came to the U.S. in the 70s. She fought tradition, left home when her parents wanted her to marry at the age of 13. She came to the U.S. on a nursing visa and sent money home to educate the remaining children in her family, and went on to get her own doctorate in public health and have an illustrious career as a statistician, marrying when she wanted to, had me when she wanted to. But she was obsessed with my education. I had to learn my multiplication tables when I was three. She expected me to skip grades, collect degrees. So in her mind, education was the only thing that couldn't be taken away from me. So it was definitely her responsibility to make sure I had a lot of it. So I found myself in North Carolina with a great in-state college right next door, and that's where I applied, got in early, and finished my undergrad and my master's degree in biostats.
First of all, what an amazing woman. I'm sure a huge inspiration. So as we said, you studied biostatistics. For those of us less familiar, what does that actually mean, Geetha?
It's looking at medical data as they're testing new drugs in different phases of development and helping pharma companies get those drugs approved by the FDA so they can be used with patients.
Did you start your career, I guess it was Chiron Pharma, right, in 2000?
I was working at Glaxo prior to that and then came out to Chiron as I moved to California.
And tell me what kind of projects you're working on, just to give people a sense of like what that work is like.
Yeah, it's a lot of data analysis, looking at various trials as patients were trying drugs for the first time, phase one, phase two trials. I did a lot of SAS programming, for those who know that software package, a lot of coding, and helping us figure out if their drugs were having the intended effects.
Interesting. Okay, so then help me on timeline. You move out to California. Do you start studying at Berkeley while you're carrying a full-time job, or how did this overlap all work?
Simultaneously, I realized perhaps I hadn't taken as much time as I was growing up to find my true calling and find the things that I was passionate about. And initially, I thought, you know, Berkeley's right next door, take some classes in some areas I may not have had time to learn about that would be of interest, and found myself in a South Asian studies program, just learning about parts of the world that were close to my heart due to my family's background, and then turned that into a new academic career, if you will, because I realized that statistics could be used in the social sciences as well.
Yeah. So expand on that for me. What does that mean?
So I find myself in a class, a South Asian politics class, where the professor was the chair of political science at Berkeley and was using statistics to look at voter expectations around the world. What do voters expect from different political parties, and how is that tied to ideology and their basic needs? I make the jump to pursuing a dissertation, a PhD in South Asian politics specifically, spent some time in India in various constituencies, working with the election commissions and things like that to see what voters' expectations were from government and whether they were realistic or not. And it was a life-altering experience for me.
That's fantastic. And so you were able to repurpose sort of your statistics background to use it in the social and political sciences arena.
Exactly.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, so 2005, you became a program officer at the American India Foundation. What is that foundation and what were you doing then?
So as I am completing my dissertation, I'm running these surveys in Asia. I was teaching a little bit, and I realized that my heart and head aligned when working with community organizations that were doing good. So as I was doing these surveys, there were a lot of community organizations that were doing some really seemingly basic things, like trying to bring a light to their street or get ration cards for their families to make sure they had food at home. And so that got me interested in the social sector more broadly to understand, you know, what I could do, whether my skill sets would be valuable in the sector. And as luck would have it, one of the co-founders of Room to Read was married to a statistician who I happened to work with. And that's how I came to find Room to Read initially. But they were small at the time, and they had just been funded by the American India Foundation for their expansion into India. So I was introduced to the American India Foundation that was doing programs, technology programs and education across India, as well as a number of other community-based programs. And so I started working with them initially, just volunteering to understand how the sector worked and how organizations like that worked, and ultimately was hired in as a program officer to help them run their educational technology program in India.
Fantastic. All right. Now, Sogita, I gave a very bare bones description of Room to Read at the beginning. What is the actual mission of the organization?
Room to Read is founded on the belief that world change starts with educated children. And as an organization, we are focused on creating a world free from illiteracy and gender inequality through education. We do this by developing early grade literacy skills and life skills for adolescents so that they can become fulfilled adults and so that they can have the skills they need to solve their most pressing challenges.
So a lot's evolved over the last 13 years since you first started working there. But as you said, when you started, it was small. How small? What was it when you joined?
So when I started at Room to Read, that was 2009. We were in 8 countries, I believe, at the time. And we had a budget of around 30 to 33 million or so. And we were really focused on proving that our models worked in literacy and gender equality. So helping children learn how to read and proving that we could have them read no matter what language we were working in by grade 3, and putting in libraries so that they could then practice those skills and develop their habit of reading. And then on the girls' education side, helping girls in their adolescent years who are at high risk complete secondary school with the skills they needed to make good choices. We've grown now to a budget of about $65 million as an organization this year, and are working across 21 countries. We have a staff of 1,600, and we've experienced some exponential scale, benefiting more than 32 million children worldwide.
Tell me personally, that first role, what was your first job when you stepped in the door?
When I first joined, I was helping to build institutional partnerships. So helping Room to Read leverage its already very influential individual supporter base to build partnerships with companies around the world. We had been pretty successful in gaining support from the finance sector and a number of banks, but we hadn't really ventured into other sectors like technology and consumer-facing brands. So a lot of my focus was identifying partners who could resonate with our mission and help us get where we wanted to go.
So development jobs, I sometimes find no matter who you are, they can be hard for people to adjust to. Asking people for money, no matter how good the cause, can be hard at times. How did you evolve the part of your skill set that, you know, was new to you? How did you learn how to be good at that job?
Interestingly, the part that came easier to me than other development professionals was the quantitative side, obviously, given my history. And so at that particular moment in Room to Read's history, it needed to think about financial sustainability and its revenue model and diversifying. And that part came easy to me. I could build financial models and I could think about diversification. Yeah. So in some ways, it was almost the opposite of what some of my colleagues were facing, where relationship management maybe came a little easier to them. As I went, though, I realized that I wasn't asking for myself. And I think that's made it a lot easier in this job. I really am looking at every individual who's sitting opposite the table from the perspective of how they can find their own channels to have social impact and positive impact in the world. And I truly believe that most people are seeking that. It's been quite the revelation for me, in fact, and probably a huge positive for those interested in social justice, that the binary between for-profit and nonprofit is really a thing of the past. I mean, people and organizations have become infused with a sense of purpose in unique ways. And I think the spectrum from for-profit to nonprofit is just getting wider in range and nuance with impact investing and ESG frameworks and cause marketing. You are seeing so many new and innovative ways for nonprofit, private, and public sector to work together. And I've found that in my career, just because social sector organizations marry practice and purpose and we infuse our hearts into what we do, it doesn't mean that we're not founded and run on sound business principle.
Yeah, and I would recommend for people who haven't listened yet to last season's episode, you know, we had the CEO of Amalgamated Bank, Priscilla Brown, on, who spoke very thoughtfully about doing well by doing good. Well, I'm a huge believer in that myself, and you guys are examples of it. I'd also say, even I can do the math, you know, you're serving almost three times as many countries and your budget isn't three times what it was. You guys are run incredibly well and incredibly efficiently in delivering your cause. Okay, so Geeta, you're good at what you do. You end up being successful. You end up taking over, running development for Room to Read, and then eventually in 2018, you take on the role as CEO of the organization. Tell me about that evolution, in particular with an eye towards, you know, being a CEO is different. It's different than where you started and how you complemented your skill set and learned how to be successful in your new roles.
I started as the first non-founder CEO of an 18-year-old organization. You know, Room to Read had been successful. So my first and most pressing realization was that I was accountable for the impact Room to Read could have. And the organization had been successful in benefiting millions of children. And as someone who had achievement just drilled into me from a young age, I needed to make sure we accelerated our ability to benefit the most children possible with the best programs possible at the lowest cost in the least amount of time. So that's how I started my role as CEO, with the sole focus.
It's that simple.
That simple. Sole focus on achieving that goal, right? That was really all I had in my mind as we were making decisions. But I learned very quickly that I could never plan for everything, and how I handled pressure and change was going to be how my organization did. So when the pandemic hit and 1 billion children were out of school, we had to pivot quickly to protect the organization from any financial hardship. But we had to continue benefiting children. So that meant serving children by camel, boat, radio, television, SMS, the internet, anything it took and whatever was available. But we also had to be a thoughtful and empathetic employer under completely new circumstances. We were redesigning the organization end to end. And I guess at the same time as these things go, I was diagnosed with a spinal tumor that had to be surgically removed. And so I had to redesign my own life from end to end alongside. So very rarely does anything go according to plan. The reality is that as much as achievement had driven me for so much of my life, I now had to look for those treasures as we went. I had to take advantage of those opportunities as we moved forward that would be in the best interest of our end goal and the children we serve.
And you brought up the impact of COVID. I mean, you're the CEO for a couple of years and then immediately a global pandemic hits. And as you say, that actually created much more rather than less need for what you guys do. How were you able to steer the organization through that? Like, what specifically did you as Room to Read have to do to navigate those, you know, unprecedented waters?
We really were redesigning the organization from end to end. We are implementers at our core. The majority of our budget and our people are directed to schools, to children in these countries around the world. And so with schools closed, we had to think about where children were. And they were at home in many cases with parents who were illiterate themselves, who may be working day to day as day laborers and could not devote the hours that might be needed to help children learn during the day. And so that's where we really had to get creative and look at what was available to children. And in a lot of places, education went online. That wasn't an option for 70% of the children that we serve. And so we ended up looking at radio and television and some of these offline options to make sure children had what they needed to continue learning during this period. And then internally, of course, you go from management team meetings that are perhaps once every 2 weeks to meeting two or three times a week and moving quickly through decisions and making sure your staff are protected and safe.
When we've interviewed for-profit or nonprofit CEOs, they often will tell us some version of there are learnings out of this that are broadly applicable regardless of whether there's a global pandemic. There's things that we've done that we're going to continue out of the last couple of years. Are there business practice changes that you look back and say, actually, like, I hate that we had to be forced to do that, but it's evolved in a way that makes sense for us going forward?
Yeah, I think all of our systems and processes and our people were forced to be more flexible and more nimble. And we've always considered ourselves a pretty nimble organization. We're privately funded. We can pretty much make the decisions we want to make when we make them and see the need. But this tested our flexibility. And I think we found some places in our programs, you know, where we could involve parents and continue to involve them as we move ahead, even as kids come back to school. We found some places where we could provide some additional supports to teachers and to governments that will continue into our programs as we move ahead. And I think we learned as a staff that, you know, we're capable of a lot more than we thought we were. And we're a pretty hard charging organization as it is. But these types of situations always push you to think differently, to think outside your box, if you will, in ways that you perhaps hadn't really thought of before. And we definitely saw that to be the case.
So 5 years into your role, give or take, what accomplishment during your tenure are you most excited about so far?
I think by far, it's that we've accelerated the number of children we've benefited per year. So just to give you a sense, when we entered this strategic plan period for ourselves, which is 2020 to 2024, we had benefited 20 million children. And my goal was to double that number in a 5-year period. So that's 4xing your number of children benefited per year. And we've achieved that. We're well on our way to doing that. And we've done so in a way that, as you noted, scaling your budget is not necessary to scale your impact. And we've gotten quite creative in the ways that we've reached these children in a way that will transform systems and benefit many more millions of children in the years to come.
You guys are doing amazing things. You talked about your strategic planning. Let's fast forward 3 years. If you look back in 3 years, what will you consider success? You talked about expanding the number of children served, but what are your biggest near-term goals and how are you guys going to execute against them?
Success for me would be able to go out into the world and not just present Room to Read's strategic plan, but present the global plans for eradicating illiteracy and gender inequality. These are huge issues, of course, and issues that Room to Read can't tackle alone. But with every year that I'm in this role, I see our networks of influence. I see what's possible when like-minded people from different walks of life and sectors come together around one solid goal. And we've already proven how much we can do in a fairly short period of time with the right goals and the right resources and the right approach. So for me, that would be a huge success to be able to say, you know, this is what it would take for us to eradicate these issues during our lifetimes.
You've got lofty and laudable goals. What are the hardest challenges for you? Like when you look at your impediments to execution against that, what worries you over the next couple of years?
There are a few things, right? I mean, one is there are a lot of distractions in this world and a lot of issues that we're trying to face, be it poverty or inequalities in healthcare, or climate issues. There's a number of issues that take our attention. And I'm just a firm believer in the fact that education is a solution to most of the world's problems. So if you have large challenges around the world, the best way to solve them is to have more problem solvers who are equipped to solve them. And I can't imagine a better investment of my time than in the young people who will be left to take care of this world when all of us move on.
Incredibly well said. So, Geetha, listen, we are huge fans of what you guys are doing. We are huge believers in it and excited to hear about what you've been up to and what you're going to be doing in the coming years. With that, let's move to the last segment of the podcast, something we like to call Best Ideas. It's where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently. Best Ideas, because it's our goal as investors to always maximize exposure to those. Geetha, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
My best idea is to read, listen to, and tell more stories. Stories help us imagine other possibilities, remember lessons, inspire action. They are powerful tools that I think are severely underutilized. And Room to Read is a children's book publisher, 6,000 original books and adaptations in 40 plus languages, one of the largest publishers in some of these languages. And we do that work because we think children need books that are mirrors where they can see themselves and windows where children can look into and learn about other worlds. And recently, I've been inspired by the power of storytelling through a powerful partnership we have with a company called Rebel Girls, which is a commercial global multi-platform empowerment brand that is helping raise the next generation of inspired and confident girls. And one of the most exciting facets of that partnership is that four incredible young women in our girls' education program have been featured in their recently released book, Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, 100 Inspiring Young Changemakers. And these are young women that the world might not hear of otherwise. Young women like Dumini, who created an agricultural hub in her village after her family struggled with food scarcity, or Trang, who's supporting her family that used to make its livelihood day-to-day selling sweet cakes with a popular YouTube channel now in Vietnam, along with her duck, Beam Beam. So reading these stories, they help reiterate my point that you don't have to change the whole world. You can just start by changing your own world. And I think these young women are doing just that. So I hope your listeners will pick up a copy.
That's fantastic. Rebel Girls, Geetha. Yes?
Rebel Girls, yes.
Love it. All right. So then before I start mine, I'm going to offer up two best ideas for you this week. So if you, like me, are inspired by Geetha and what she and her organization are doing to change the world, go to roomtoread.org right now. There's a big yellow donate button on the top right, and give something that you find personally impactful. I promise you, your dollars will be incredibly well spent, and I could not endorse her or organization more. But let me give you my actual best idea this week, or my traditional one. As listeners know, I like to be inspired by the guests of the week. Geetha runs an organization dedicated to childhood literacy, and I felt like, therefore, I should offer a book up. In particular, one that I've recently enjoyed reading at the same time as one of my teenage children. I have three kids. My oldest, Tabor, is particularly keen on mythology. And this one is a recommendation from them. They actually had to read it for school. My best idea this week is a fantastic book. It came out in 2018 called Circe by Madeline Miller. Miller is a classic scholar, and she wrote Circe to be a reimagining of the character from the Odyssey, Circe, where the whole story is from her perspective rather than she being a side character in Odysseus's journey. It is rich and beautifully written, and it's a truly thought-provoking novel. The author's deep, sort of rich classics background means that it's cleverly interlaced with characters and themes from the broader Greek myth canon. So, in honor of a woman who is in herself reimagining the world, let me recommend one of my favorite books I've read recently, Circe by Madeline Miller. Geetha, have you ever checked that book out?
I have not, but it's now on my list. I have a 13-year-old daughter at home, so it sounds like a fun one for us to read together.
It's fantastic. Highly recommended. Well, Geetha, with that, it's time to wrap up for the week. Thank you so much again for taking the time with us today.
Thanks, Colbert. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, Geetha Murali. Check out our show notes to learn more about Geetha and her organization, Room to Read. You'll also find a link to her best idea, the Rebel Girl series, as well as my best idea, the novel Circe by Madeline Miller. If you, like us, are inspired by Geetha and Room to Read, please go to their website, roomtoread.org, and donate. This podcast was brought to you by Atwill Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.